Support for WAMC comes from Waterwheel Village, Galway, New York, specializing in extra sharp New York cheddar since 1923, offering imported cheddars, specialty cheeses, nostalgic candies, local baked goods, honey and maple products in every corner of our store. WaterwheelVillage.com. Fear Brothers Industries in Saugerties, New York, providing steel hardware since 1949, a proud sponsor of WAMC, announcing their new website, FEHR.com. This is a WAMC News Update. I'm Brian Shields. The U.S. Senate today overwhelmingly passed and sent to President Obama a massive education bill. It would return to the states significant control over school accountability and testing, and the president is expected to sign it. The measure would replace the long-outdated No Child Left Behind law of 2002. FBI Director James Comey says the two San Bernardino shooters were radicalized at least 2 years ago and had discussed jihad and martyrdom as early as 2013. Comey told the Senate Judiciary Committee today that investigators believe Saeed Farouk and his wife Tashfeen Malik were radicalized even before they began an online relationship. The jury in the Dean Skelos corruption trial could get the case later today at the completion of closing arguments by the defense. The Long Island Republican, who stepped down as the Senate Majority Leader this year after his arrest but now still remains in the legislature, is accused of using his political influence and intimidation to financially benefit his son Adam, who was also on trial. A synagogue in West Hartford, Connecticut, is asking police for enhanced security after encountering two suspicious women that attended Saturday services at the House of Worship. An email sent to the Congregation of Emmanuel Synagogue by its president, Sheila Silverman, said that two women dressed in caftan robes and headscarves were acting out of the ordinary after attending the end of Shabbat services on December 5th. A federal grand jury in Vermont has brought new charges against two New York men accused of operating a large-scale drug conspiracy in the state. 26-year-old Gary DeLima and 26-year-old Sharif Cargo are now being accused of distributing the fatal dose of fentanyl that killed 54-year-old Gary Pashaw on July 6th of last year. New York's Attorney General is looking into whether speculative ticket listings for Bruce Springsteen's 2016 tour on ticket resale sites constitute deceptive advertising. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman sent letters to StubHub, Ticket Network, and Vivid Seats asking about the practice of offering seats on secondary markets when the seller may not possess the tickets. Tickets for Springsteen's tour, which will make a stop in Albany, do not go on sale until February or until Friday, but hundreds of seats have already been listed for up to $5,000 or more on some resale sites. The federal government has approved a major step to allow Berkshire Scenic Railway to set up service between Adams and North Adams, but officials are hoping the deal can be closed in time for the holiday train to run this year. The Berkshire Eagle reports Washington will allow the State Department of Transportation in Massachusetts to acquire just over 4.5 miles of track from Pan Am Southern. On Wall Street, energy companies and suppliers of raw materials rose sharply, along with the price of oil and other commodities. Dow Chemical and DuPont soared following reports that the two were in talks to combine. Costco fell after reporting disappointing earnings. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 13 points, 17,581. The S&P is down 5 at 2,058. The NASDAQ is down 43 at 5,054. But what a forecast, a partly sunny afternoon. Today's highs mid-40s, cloudy and mild tonight with showers, some fog. Overnight low in the upper 30s to near 40. Tomorrow morning, some clouds, perhaps a shower, then increasing sunshine in the lower 50s. Morning clouds on Friday, a partly sunny afternoon in the highs in the low to mid-50s. A cloudy weekend, but mild in the 50s. Montpelier, Vermont at this hour is cloudy. It's 39. Adams, Massachusetts at 41. Oneonta, partly cloudy, 47. Albany, mostly cloudy, 45 degrees. You're listening to Midday Magazine on WAMC. As the massive Albany Convention Center project construction continues, officials presented an update on downtown Albany and its business scene this morning. WAMC's Capital Region Bureau Chief Dave Lucas was at the Hospitality Summit.
A series of speakers and panelists at the Hampton Inn and Suites on Chapel Street addressed and interacted with a breakfast audience of business people, meeting planners, restaurateurs, community leaders, officials, and interested citizens. The focus was on the Albany Capital Center construction and all phases of development. The project has turned a large square of downtown land into a bustling construction zone. Discussion revolved around how much progress Albany has seen since construction of the South Mall was completed and the ongoing effort to revitalize the downtown area. Albany City Treasurer Darius Shanfar says the rebirth of downtown is in full bloom.
What we have going on downtown, not only do we have the renaissance in downtown Albany, we also have a renaissance going on here. And that includes apartment living downtown, it includes more hotels, it includes more services for people to come here, the convention center obviously, more restaurants and bars, and that requires a real culture of quality hospitality to serve the people who are now living and also the numbers who are going to be coming, the greater numbers who are going to be coming to downtown.
Michelle Vinard, President and CEO of the Albany County Convention and Visitors Bureau, agrees.
Aesthetics is some of it, connectivity, some of the activities dealing with what kind of Wi-Fi do we have downtown. Connectivity as it deals with transportation is important. Those are, the things that people have asked us for. They asked us about those after the June conference, and so that's why we wanted to come back and say, and here's some of the programs that we have put forward, some of the training programs for hospitality excellence, and that they will continue in 2016.
The summit lauded the positives of Albany's history and art, elements that are being rolled into the process of marketing downtown facilities. Officials say the various construction and reconstruction projects across the downtown area promote walkability and act as an added value in promotion of heritage tourism. Vinard adds there was dialogue over taming signage downtown.
There's huge signage clutter. There are signs for different things in different formats, and so one of the things that the bid is going to be undertaking is an inventory of signage so we can approach it more comprehensively so that when we're welcoming people who are not familiar with the city that you're guiding them in the appropriate way.
On the sales and marketing end, promoters cited Albany's distinct historical aspects and landmarks, along with attractions in the area. Bob Belber is the regional general manager with SMG of the Times Union Center and the Albany Capital Center.
The Albany Capital Center is an exciting new property that's going to open in downtown. SMG manages Albany Capital Center. We've got our sales team and marketing team aggressively pursuing every lead to bring in new conventions, consumer shows, weddings, annual events for corporations. We use various different trade shows in the industry where meeting planners will gather. Our SMG company has 75 different properties that are convention centers throughout the United States, and we share information. A lot of the bigger meeting planning organizations actually work exclusively with SMG, and many times they'll revolve their conventions and large-scale meetings around the country and different locations. So we look at this opportunity to bring more of those into Albany. Some are going to be bigger than the space that Albany Capital Center will be. So we'll work with the Empire State Plaza, we'll work with the Times Union Center, connect via a brand new renovated walkway, and the 159,000 square feet of space collectively is the biggest in the state of New York.
Belber says the region can expect to see a whole lot of business and much more vehicle and pedestrian traffic soon. Dave Lucas, WAMC News.
A plan to open a 95-room hotel at the site of a now-shuttered school in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, is drawing the ire of some residents, while the developer sees it as a boost for the southern Berkshire County town. WAMC's Berkshire's Bureau Chief Jim Lavoulis reports.
79 Bridge Street Realty LLC is going before the Great Barrington Select Board December 16th to detail updated plans for the Searle School. Completed in 1898, the school closed about 10 years ago because of regional consolidation. It is owned by Jane Iredell's family, whose cosmetic headquarters sits next to the property in another former school. Now the Mejia family, who have a string of hotels in the Berkshires, wants to build a $25 million upscale boutique 95-room hotel called the Berkshire. Dave Carpenter is the director of administration for the Mejia family hospitality interests.
So it will have a restaurant. It will have a pool and fitness center. It has corporate meeting space. And it's a full-service hotel, not a limited service. That is, it has a bellman. It has a gift shop. And I think very uniquely, it has a library that is going to feature the books and artifacts on the history of the Housatonic River. I think that's a neat little feature because, as you may know, the Riverwalk actually starts right at the Searle's location.
The developers are updating their plans after Great Barrington's town council said some of the school has to be saved. The opinion came because a town bylaw prohibits construction of hotels with more than 45 rooms unless the project involves reuse of a historic structure. The developers worked with the Historical Commission to have the Searle School so designated. Confident reuse is realistic. Bobby Houston is part of a group committed to saving the school.
What was baffling right from the start was that the Mejia group and Jane Iredell had the building brought in front of the Historic Commission to be certified as a historic building. And then in the very next sentence, basically, they said, oh, P.S., we're going to knock it down. So it was crazy-making right from the start. The proposal just didn't make sense.
A website and Facebook page garnering more than 1,000 likes have served as message boards for like-minded people. Houston, an Academy Award-winning documentary filmmaker and self-proclaimed small fry developer, says he has offered the Iredell family $500,000 for the school with the primary goal of saving it.
There's so many incredible examples of schools and public buildings that have been repurposed. And the needs of the town, you know, will make themselves felt. There is a need for more density downtown. I personally think that locals bring more vitality and more real business to a downtown.
Houston, who is redeveloping greenhouses near the school, says the Iredell family has asked him to wait and see what comes of the Mejia's plans since they have agreed to a contract for the site. Carpenter says a project of this financial size requires 95 rooms to be profitable. He says the hotel will employ about 30 people, generate more than $450,000 in annual taxes, and be a shot in the arm for downtown.
It'll have the kind of impact that the Red Lion Inn has in downtown Stockbridge.
Responding to some opponents' claims, Carpenter says there has been no end run regarding the school's historical designation.
Everything has been done according to town bylaws. The Historical Commission was well aware through their chairman of what our plans was.
The town's Historical Commission is recommending preservation of the school's key architectural features. Beth Carlson lives in Stockbridge but works in Great Barrington. She's heavily involved in the Save the School effort and says there are those in town who don't want a 95-room hotel.
I was actually considering buying, have been looking at properties in Great Barrington and wanting to move to the neighborhood that would be most affected by this hotel. And when I heard about this project, I was like, well, I don't want to live near that project, nor do I think I want to live in a town where this could happen.
Carpenter says whether the project goes forward lies with the select board. The developers will detail how they plan to reuse portions of the school at the December 16th meeting. They will also answer site-specific questions at a planning board meeting Thursday. Reporting from WAMC's Berkshire Bureau at the Berkshire Eagle, I'm Jim Lavoulis.
The Massachusetts Coalition Against Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence, known as Jane Doe Incorporated, announced the group's 2016 White Ribbon Campaign at the State House in Boston on Tuesday. The campaign is a primary prevention strategy to help end male violence against women. WAMC's Pioneer Valley Bureau Chief Paul Tuthill spoke with Jane Doe's Men's Initiative Coordinator, Craig Norberg Baum.
This is our ninth annual campaign, so March 3rd, 2016 will be our next statewide White Ribbon Day, which is we consider a day of celebration for men participating in solutions. The White Ribbon Campaign is international. It launched in Montreal in 1991. So that many years ago, there was a crime in Montreal in 1989, a couple of years before, that was the tipping point for men taking action. It was a mass murder at a university. A man had an automatic weapon, went into an engineering school in Montreal, and separated all the women from the men and then killed all the women. So 14 women died, and many others were wounded, and he ultimately killed himself and left a note saying how he hated feminists and how women were in his way going to school. And this was a tipping point for responses in Canada, and 2 years later they launched the White Ribbon Campaign, which was to ask men across the country to wear white ribbon in commemoration of those dead and to promise to be part of the solution, to allow this never to occur again in our name. And so this has gone on since that time. The campaign has flourished in countries around the world. The United Nations has picked it up as part of the Unite campaign. And there's a large campaign in the country of Australia, New Zealand, Brazil, and we brought it to Massachusetts.
It's been 9 years, you said. Has it been successful?
We feel it has been. The purpose of the campaign and the major measure is, will men mobilize? Will men join us and pick up this particular cause? And we didn't know that men would at the beginning. I mean, there were individuals like myself who cared about it, but we didn't know if, as a large, in any large quantities, men would come to this. And so that's what we're looking for. And we have to say that we're doing events at the State House of 500-plus men, and we're doing local proclamation events at cities and towns across the Commonwealth where, you know, 30s and 50s of men will come together and take this pledge. And then schools are doing it, as well as city agencies and community organizations. So I feel like we're coming a long way.
And there's a traveling exhibit that is going to be going around the state in the coming year. Can you talk about that?
It sure is. This is new for us. We've just constructed an exhibit that portrays the character of the heart of men doing this work. And we've did some professional photography with 13 of the Corps ambassadors. The ambassador is the role that men take as leadership in the campaign. And you can join us as an ambassador very easily yourself by coming to our website. And some of the men get very active in their local communities, and we've chosen a group of those men to bring forward and to celebrate their work, and we've portrayed it in this wonderful museum quality display called the Display of Character, Men Reimagining Manhood. And so that will be on display at the Massachusetts State House for the rest of the week, and then we will have it travel around the Commonwealth to different localities.
I assume we'll see it here in Western Massachusetts at some point during 2016.
Yes, no doubt. No doubt. We have very active folks in Western Mass area, UMass Amherst with the Every Women's Center, and then in Holyoke with Women's Shelter Compañeras, and with the MOCA organization, Men of Color Health Awareness, in Springfield at the YWCA there. They're very active organizations promoting the same message.
Is your message primarily aimed at young people in an effort to stop the cycles of abuse and violence, which we know, you know, research has found, you know, young men who see abuse or are victims of abuse are more likely to abuse when they become adults?
Yeah. So when it's role model for you, you tend to do it. And so you do what your dad did kind of thing. It's pretty common. And launching from that, we want dads to reflect on this and behave differently and to be on purpose about teaching these values to their kids. So we work with dads a lot. I'm glad you mentioned dads. We also work with sports coaches because they influence the viewpoint of character for boys quite strongly, as do sports players. So we're very active in this. So it's adult. The focus of the campaign is to get adult men who are ready to help with this to mobilize and start doing things with their own friends and the kids they know. So that's the core work of the campaign, is to mobilize men ready to help.
Craig Norberg Bohm of Jane Doe Incorporated speaking with Paul Tuthill. O'clock today, the Commonwealth Club, Confronting ISIS, a town hall. Today at 2 on Vox Pop, the Career Forum. A coalition of groups is asking Vermont lawmakers to study the possibility of expanding a program that provides low-cost insurance coverage to children. WAMC's North Country Bureau Chief Pat Bradley reports.
Vermont's Dr. Dinosaur is described by the state as, quote, low-cost or free health coverage for children, teenagers under age 19, and pregnant women, unquote. Depending on income qualifications, premiums range from nothing to $60 per month. Several groups are calling on the Vermont legislature to expand availability of coverage to Vermonters age 26 and under, regardless of income. They are asking that a commission study the implications of implementation of such an expansion. Main Street Alliance Vermont is a nonprofit that works with small business owners on public policy issues. Director Lindsay Delaurier says they have done enough work on the idea to feel expansion of the Dr. Dinosaur program is something the state should study. She says their initial research shows Dr. Dinosaur 2 would save employers and families money by eliminating family plans.
It will make family plans obsolete in the state. All the kids will be covered, and since everyone under 27 will be covered, the portion of the workforce that falls into that category will also automatically be covered. So it will reduce the scope of health insurance benefits that employers are paying. We're confident that this is going to save Vermont money on balance. And frankly, if it doesn't, you know, we have this Dr. Dinosaur 2.0 promise, as we're calling it, which is if after the numbers are run, the study has happened, if this isn't going to save Vermont money, we will walk away from this plan. Our intention is to save Vermont money and to make healthcare more affordable.
The Mule Bar in Winooski specializes in craft beers and comfort foods. Owner Wes Hamilton says he regrets that he cannot afford to provide insurance coverage to his employees and would like to see the Dr. Dinosaur coverage expanded.
The food industry is a low-wage industry and often are, you know, younger in their 20s, and it's pretty much universal in my experience. Your waiter or the dishwasher in the kitchen or the person putting together the salad is almost certainly coming to work when they're sick and should be home. And that is a matter of not being able to afford the medical care or not being able to afford to take the time off of work. So from that perspective, it's a little bit of a no-brainer that there should be, you know, more than just up to 27, but I think expanding the current Dr. Dinosaur program is a great first step.
UVM sophomore Lachlan Francis from Putney could benefit if revisions are made to the Dr. Dinosaur program. He says the current system perpetuates a fear of seeking health care because costs are too high, and the proposal offers an opportunity to provide care and save costs.
As a soon-to-be college graduate, I do want to stay in Vermont, but the fact is, entry-level wages are low, cost of living is high, premiums are rising at an unsustainable rate, and high deductibles and high out-of-pocket costs make health insurance unaffordable, especially people who are young or entering the workforce and who may not be able to even find full-time employment in the field that they study. So when you consider the fact that student loan debt is skyrocketing, I think it is unrealistic to pay for their insurance. I just don't think it's possible.
The coalition is asking that the legislature form a commission in 2016 and have potential legislation ready by the 2017 session. Delaurier says in 2018, under the Affordable Care Act, an excise tax will be imposed on high-cost plans, and many in Vermont would meet the threshold for the 40% excise tax. If the Dr. Dinosaur 2 plan is implemented, she says, those plans would be eliminated and the excise tax avoided. I'm Pat Bradley, WAMC News.
Support for WAMC comes from Poughkeepsie Day School, pre-K through grade 11. Open house begins 8:45 a.m. Monday, January 11th, where learning comes to life and passion finds a purpose. PoughkeepsieDay.org for RSVP. Capital Roots, celebrating 40 years of providing fresh food and green spaces for the Capital Region. Grow, educate, provide. CapitalRoots.org for details. Meteorologist Paul Caiano has the midday weather summary.
Good afternoon. High pressure has been keeping it dry across interior New York and New England, and that high will hold on strong today. It will allow some mid and high level clouds to continue across the region. However, some breaks of sunshine will get through in some places more than others. That, with the combination of a light southerly breeze around the backside of the high, will push temperatures into the middle to upper 40s for afternoon highs, with some spots in the lower Hudson Valley and southern New England even getting into the lower 50s. A weak disturbance pushing through the Midwest at this time will work its way through the Great Lakes today and into our region late tonight and first thing tomorrow morning. It's not a particularly strong system, and it's relatively moisture-starved, yet we do run the risk at a few passing rain showers, with temperatures staying above freezing, mainly from the mid-30s to lower 40s. Areas of fog also possible as this disturbance passes through. So we'll wake up tomorrow morning with some clouds and maybe even a few showers, then some sunshine will come back, and highs will push into the lower 50s. At this point, we'll watch a big ridge of high pressure reestablish itself over the eastern third of the country. That's going to bring even milder air our way for the end of the week and into the weekend. On Friday and Saturday, we'll have a mixture of sunshine and clouds with high pressure in control, lower to mid-50s, and even in the middle and upper 50s on Sunday, although with that warmer air coming in, there's the risk of a few showers from the south. A stronger disturbance will head our way on Sunday night and for the day on Monday, and rain is likely to start next week. Still, Monday afternoon will be in the mid-50s before we cool it off into the 40s behind that system with drier weather on Tuesday. Taking a look at potentially significant weather today, fast jet stream flow will push multiple disturbances across the country through the midweek period. One system will move over the Pacific Northwest and travel to the Great Lakes by tomorrow night. A second system will move over the Pacific Northwest tomorrow and move into the northern and central Rockies. Multiple plumes of moisture from the Pacific will accompany these disturbances over parts of the West Coast and produce waves of rain and higher elevation snow from the Pacific Northwest to the central California area eastward to parts of the northern and central Rockies. Strong winds are also likely with these disturbances. Flood watches and warnings have been issued for up to 4 to 8 inches of rain in the northwest. Winter storm warnings are out for the Sierras, where 2 to 3 feet of snow may accumulate in the highest terrain and as much as 1 to 2 feet at pass level. The past 24 hours, lower 48 states' temperature extremes ran from a high of 87 degrees at Van Nuys and Fillmore, both in California, to a low of 10 at Alamosa and Gunnison, both in Colorado. For those traveling across the Northeast today, New York City partly sunny in the lower 50s, Boston partly sunny in the mid-40s, and in Buffalo, partly sunny skies with highs in the lower 50s. The average high temperature in Albany today, 38 degrees, the average low, 24. The record high, 62, set in 1966, and the record low, 11 below zero, in 1902. Sunrise this morning at 7:14 a.m., sunset this evening at 4:21 p.m., 9 hours and 7 minutes of daylight, a loss of 1 minute from yesterday. Here are my latest regional forecasts for the Northern Adirondacks and Central and Northern Vermont, as well as the Champlain Valley and Lake George area. Partly sunny today with highs in the mid-40s. Cloudy with a few rain showers and mountain sleet or wet snow. Areas of fog also tonight with lows in the lower to mid-30s. For the Connecticut Valley and mid and lower Hudson Valley, as well as for the remainder of interior southern New England, a mix of sun and clouds today with highs right around 50. Cloudy with a few rain showers and some fog tonight and lows in the lower to mid-40s. For the northern Catskills and Mohawk Valley west of Amsterdam, as well as for the southern Adirondacks, a mix of sun and clouds today with highs in the mid to upper 40s. Cloudy with a few rain showers and areas of fog tonight with lows in the mid to upper 30s. For the southern Catskills, Taconics, and southern Berkshires, as well as for the Litchfield Hills, a mix of sun and clouds today with highs in the upper 40s. Cloudy with a few rain showers and some fog tonight in the lower 40s. For the greater Capital District, including Albany, Schenectady, and Troy, as well as for the Saratoga area, east into southern Vermont and the Berkshires, north of I-90. A mix of sun and clouds today with highs in the mid to upper 40s. cloudy with a few rain showers tonight. Also, areas of fog with lows in the upper 30s and lower 40s. Region-wide for tomorrow, a morning shower, then increasing sun, lower 50s. A mix of sun and clouds Friday and Saturday, lower to mid-50s. Partly sunny Sunday with a shower possible in the upper 50s. Cloudy and breezy with rain likely Monday in the mid-50s and back to the 40s with a mix of sun and clouds Tuesday. For WAMC, I'm News Channel 13 meteorologist Paul Caiano.
Support for WAMC comes from Colorful Stitches Fine Yarns, Lenox, Massachusetts, offering gift cards for the knitters and crocheters on your holiday list. ColorfulStitches.com. Bedard Brothers Cheshire, featuring 7 brands in 1 location. Chevrolet, Honda, Volvo, Chrysler, Jeep, Dodge, and Ram, plus late model pre-owned cars and trucks. It's hard to beat Bedard. Online, BedardBrothers.com.
Hey, it's Berkshire Bureau Chief Jim Lavoulis. Like most, 2015 has been an up-and-down year. Massachusetts saw Deflategate, record snow.
I think in the end we're going to end up with somewhere between 18 and 20 inches.
And oh yeah, a new governor.
It is with great humility and high honor that I assume the office of Governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
And with your end-of-the-year gift, I'm sure 2016 will have even more in store, but hopefully not as much snow.
This is a WAMC News Update. I'm Brian Shields. A Baltimore police officer charged with manslaughter in the death of Freddie Gray has taken the stand in his own defense. Gray was a 25-year-old black man who died after suffering a spinal injury while in the back of a police van. The prosecution says Officer William Porter is partly responsible for the death. The defense says Porter acted reasonably. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel has apologized for the 2014 police shooting of a black teenager. During a special city council meeting, Emanuel promised complete and total reform to restore trust in the Chicago PD. The defense is making its closing arguments at the federal corruption trial of former New York State leader Dean Skelos and his son Adam. Deliberations could begin as early as this afternoon in the Manhattan courtroom. Yesterday, prosecutors said Skelos used his office to strong-arm 3 businesses into giving his son $300,000 in fees and benefits. The defendant's lawyers say they will be vindicated. Support for WAMC comes from Berkshire Bank, providing banking, insurance, and wealth management. With over 90 locations in New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Vermont, Berkshire Bank, America's most exciting bank, berkshirebank.com. No Child Left Behind is being left behind by both the House and Senate, who have agreed on a new comprehensive education bill that now goes to President Obama's desk. The measure, which President Obama is expected to sign, will give more power back to the states, but it will maintain federal mandates for testing for grades 3 through 8. However, states will have the authority over how those test results are used, engaging student and teacher performance. The president of the National Education Association, Lily Eskelson-Garcia, spoke with WAMC News today about the new law.
This is a very happy day for educators all over the country. This is like every Student Succeeds Act day, because it is high time that we say goodbye to test and punish and having Congress be our super school board and move towards something that really puts decisions in the hands of the people who live in the communities of those children that are impacted. We're gonna see a better day under every Student Succeeds.
What are some of the changes specifically that you like about this legislation?
I think the biggest change that people are going to see is we're moving away from that one-size-fits-all, just give 52 million school kids a standardized test in reading and math in the spring. If they don't hit the cut score, they're failures, and nothing else they do all year matters. That was No Child Left Untested. And what we were successful in moving Congress to see is that, yes, we want information, and that test score gives us so little, and you're basing huge decisions on it. Under every Student Succeeds, the public will see a dashboard of indicators. You will see things like graduation rates, proficiency in English for English language learners. And then we have the opportunity, because it's not closed, to put indicators that we can create. One of my colleagues, who's an elementary teacher, said, you know what I want to see on that dashboard? I want to know how many kids graduate from high school having already earned college credit. That is a great indicator of student success. And so we're already thinking of creative things that we can say, these are ways that we can really look at that child 360 degrees, the whole child, and serve that child in better ways.
Can schools be judged honestly together, for instance, an upper-income suburban district and a lower-income urban district?
What we don't want to go back to is simply having these test scores become like the sports page, which kids won and which kids lost. I taught at a homeless shelter for several years. I know the kinds of needs that my students came with. Sometimes they needed breakfast. Some of these kids needed things that that a child in an affluent neighborhood would never think of asking for. So our kids come to us in very different ways. What we want on this dashboard of indicators is also indicators of student supports, so that we also want to know which kids have a school nurse, a librarian, which kids have access to advanced placement courses, or gifted and talented courses, or preschool. So what we want is more information, better information. And I think that's going to be the game changer. We'll have information where the people who know the names of the kids can then look at that and say, what are we going to focus on? How are we going to move the needle on student success? What is it that we don't have that we need to go up and ask for? And we're not going alone. The way that we got every student succeeds to succeed is we brought parents with us. We brought the community leaders with us. We brought kids with us. And senators and congressmen that don't always work and play well with the NEA actually listened to that third grade teacher, to that mom of a special needs child, and they could see what was hurting them, and they could see a way forward.
What about teacher evaluations? How does this system rate teachers? Are the test scores or other scores coming out of the classrooms, coming out of the schools, going to be used to evaluate the performance of teachers?
A good teacher evaluation system is absolutely essential. And we have some good models all over the country that did not rely on hit your number on a test score and we'll call you a good teacher. You don't hit it, you're a bad teacher. For those of us that have worked with very challenging populations of kids, in my case, homeless students, we know that that's not going to work. So what this law says, basically, is it's not up to Congress to decide. It's not up to the Department of Education on the federal level to decide how a school district should evaluate their teachers. Yes, you have to have good and strong evaluation systems. We're going to be out there giving models to states, to local school districts, to our affiliates in the NEA that are in every state and practically every school district. And we're going to be saying, let's do this right. And so we were actually quite pleased that Congress said to the Department of Education, it's not your place to put pressure on states and locals to use school, test scores to judge your students or your teachers.
Lily Eskelson-Garcia is the president of the National Education Association. She spoke with WAMC News today from Washington. Clock today on Vox Pop. It's the Career Forum at 1, confronting ISIS. A town hall is the focus today on the Commonwealth Club. President Obama told the nation on Sunday night that the U.S. would defeat the Islamic State over the long run. But our commentator, Dr. Herb London, says it's important to also look at the big picture.
Microaggression, or a slight intended or unintended, has influenced public discourse from universities to world leaders. Yet it is interesting to note some slights are acceptable and others are not. It is considered inappropriate to use an adjective such as militant or radical to modify the noun Islam. However, it is increasingly appropriate to use the expression Zionist aggression, even when most Israeli military activity is defensive, a retaliation for violence inflicted on the Jewish state. In university life, any slight, however trifling, has been elevated to an issue of major significance. A Halloween costume became a matter for presidential intervention at Yale. When the president of the University of Missouri neglected to recognize a group of students at a homecoming parade, He was charged with insensitivity. Alas, the world hasn't gone completely crazy. These microaggressions are part of a left-wing strategy to disrupt prevailing convention. It is as if Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals was the playbook. Invented slights, exaggerated as normative insults, become the catalyst for disruption, and disruption is the seedbed for revolution. These efforts at disruption are indeed mindless, but even mindlessness has a purpose. On the international stage, Islam has been put in a bubble. Even suggesting that the Islamic State is Islamic cannot be countenanced. If it isn't the Islamic State, what is it? On the other hand, Islamic leaders say death to America, but the silence at the United Nations on this slight is deafening. Why is it okay to defile America and Israel, but inappropriate to criticize the dictatorial Muslim regimes? Why is Islam beyond reproach? The answer, of course, lies in fear, fear that violent reprisals will occur. A memory of 9/11 and Paris bloodshed linger in the imagination. It is the unstated but obvious justification for self-censorship. The mere suggestion that Islam is not a religion of peace awakens hostility. When President al-Sisi of Egypt said, "We need a revolution from within to challenge the violence in our faith," the bullseye in his back grew, and death threats mounted significantly. Sensitivities are growing, but these selective sensitivities. Political correctness is hereby insinuated into every crevice of public discourse. Microaggressions have taken this trend to a new level. A look might be interpreted as hostility, a gesture a matter of review. There isn't a limit to possible insult. In the process, free speech suffers and expression is stifled. In exchanges among states, language is carefully nuanced. Diplomats are coached to be cautious. It is a communications necessity. Nevertheless, microaggressions are different. It might mean a limp handshake at a G20 meeting. It could translate into an international incident over someone turning his back on his colleagues, even if unintentional. Heightened sensitivities won't go away anytime soon, yet it is also clear that some spokesmen get a pass. When the Palestinian Authority officials contend Israel planned the terror attacks in Paris, that foolish comment should be reproved by every responsible leader. The statement doesn't have a hint of reality to it, but it still hasn't been censored. There is a Chinese saying that applies to this microaggression. Where there is a will to convict, evidence is never lacking. If some people are ready to pounce on what is considered objectionable, evidence is unnecessary, at least in the culture that is emerging.
Dr. Herb London is the president of the London Center for Policy Research and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He has authored a number of books, including The Transformational Decade. Dr. London's comments can be heard Wednesdays on Midday Magazine. Your comments are welcome anytime at 800-695-9170, 800-695-9170. The views expressed by our commentators are solely those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect the views of WAMC or its management. Support for WAMC comes from Bard College Master of Arts and Teaching Program, offering one-year full-time and two-year part-time master's degrees and teacher certification. Accepting applications through April 29, 2016. Teaching What Matters, bard.edu/MAT. Ellis Medicine providing options, support, and help for surgical weight loss at the Ellis Bariatric Care Center, Schenectady, ellismedicine.org. The Office of Dr. Vivian Letizia Woodstock, Orthodontic, Cosmetic, and General Dentistry, welcoming longtime Woodstock resident and dentist Dr. Stephen Dallow to their practice, woodstockdentist.com. Mary Irish with Wall Street.
At about 12:30, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 2 points to 17,567. The Standard & Poor's 500 index is down 7 points to 2,056. And the NASDAQ composite is down 49 points to 5,049. The breadth of the market is slightly negative, with 5 declining stocks for every 4 advancing issues. The 30-year Treasury bond is currently yielding 3%. Some of the most active stocks on the big board today include Dow Chemical, up 5.32 to 56.22. General Electric is up 26 cents to 30.45, and Panera Bread is up 44 cents to 190.76. In the overseas markets last night, Tokyo's Nikkei Index closed 1% lower. In Hong Kong, the Hang Seng Index was unchanged. From Morgan Stanley Wealth Management in Niskayuna, New York, this is Mary Irish bringing you the Wall Street Update for WAMC.